Okay, welcome to episode 49 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. We have an awesome episode today covering all the different product types. There's been a lot of major publicly traded REITs that have reported earnings across the office and life science markets over the last couple of days. So a lot of interesting information coming out of that. Owen, I know you were going to kick us off with some thoughts on what's happening in the office market.
Okay, yeah, I'm really excited to talk about the office market because I want to preface it by the reality statistic-wise. Right now, the national office vacancy is north of 20%, which is a record high. Keep that in mind for this discussion we're going to have. The delinquency rate for office-backed loans is now 11%, the highest it's been since 2000. And as you would all know, because we've talked about this on previous podcasts, some landlords right now lack the capital to reposition their buildings, putting even more distress on some properties. And so what we're going to talk about today, what I want to start this discussion about is the two realities of the office market right now. So while overall vacancies remain at record highs, like I just talked about, Class A premium space, so I'm talking about the buildings that everyone wants to be in, so to speak, is in short supply, especially in prime locations. You know, we're seeing, as I mentioned, many buildings are outdated, underutilized, and lack the financial resources to go through renovations. And so there is an absolute divide right now of the haves, let's call them the people with high-end office space, and the have-nots. This is the older, you know, less desirable buildings that nobody has really wanted throughout the pandemic, and that gap is widening. Are you guys seeing that in your dealings with transactions across the country?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to talk about why is this happening, right? Like why is Class A plus office space and in such short supply in certain markets? I mean, you would think that the market would react somewhat efficiently and that people would build more of this product and all that. And like the reality is that in basically all of these markets, it takes a minimum of 3 years to be able to deliver a new construction Class A building. And in many markets, it can take, you know, 4 or 5, up to even 7 or 8 years, depending on what the redevelopment pathway is. So, you know, the market just can't respond to short-term demand with a supply that requires many, many years to kind of oscillate, which is why we constantly see these cycles in real estate, right? Where something gets really hot, everyone rushes to build, but the rush to build takes years. And then by the time they deliver, they're delivering into a market with a different demand quotient. And that's tough. Like that's why we're seeing this happen. I mean, I don't think many people in the depths of COVID granted, of course there were, and on this podcast we were talking about it, I don't think that many people thought, hey, this is going to drive Class A plus office space to actually outperform. I think people thought the Class A office space will outperform relative to lesser types of office space, but not that it would actually perform better than maybe it otherwise would have. That said though, I mean, I think it's important to note, especially in light of like everything going on with the federal government and requiring everyone to return to the office on February 6th and, you know, so on and so forth, that not every company actually wants this Class A plus office space. Like it's not a requirement for a company to have Class A office space. Of course, I like working in a really nice building. I know all of us do. I know tons of our clients do, in particular, those that are really in aggressive competition for talent. But if you're the federal government, or if you're a call center, or you're a number of these different companies where you're saying, look, I want to have people in the office to make sure they're not, you know, doing laundry, taking care of their kids, going for a walk on a conference call, I want to make sure I'm getting productivity out of them. Those people don't necessarily need the really nice offices. And I don't really think we've started to see those people push return to work as aggressively as, say, the federal government is now. So I'm curious if that will change. And Class A plus is office space is just in short supply. So this demand really puts pressure given just the finite amount that exists. But it'll be really interesting to see what happens with Class B office space as people say, wait a minute, even if I'm not in competition for talent in the same way that, you know, a FANG company is or a, you know, giant tech company is, I still want to get productivity out of these people and I'm not. So it's going to be really interesting.
I don't know, Tucker. You said people going for a walk. I usually view that as a positive. Someone gets up from the desk, goes for a walk around the office. You must be a really tough manager to work for if you don't want your people leaving the desk and go for a walk. But your point is well taken. I think everybody's learning that the efficiencies of a high-performing workplace is more important than the comforts of home. And your home life is not a high-performing workplace to create the most value for the company long-term. And I think it's important, like you mentioned New York, Owen, I would tell you that Boston is in a very similar position. And I haven't done the analysis on this to prove this out, but I would say it's probably in most markets that are not on the West Coast that are older stock markets that have limited supply of new product, certainly have a similar supply and demand issue on the newest supply, right? It's just doing work in New York. I mean, I say that, and then I'm doing work down in the Domain in Austin, and that is leasing very quickly for the best product. And it doesn't mean there's not an opportunity for, you know, half a dozen options for a client, but a year ago there was a dozen and now there's a half a dozen. So it's moving in a direction where the best product in those highly desirable, highly desirable market is moving very quickly. You know, if you think about, I'm doing a project on the peninsula in outside of San Francisco, same thing, really high-end office space. If you want something that's built out and plug and play, it's really hard to find. And it's not just New York. I think our listeners should know that companies are gravitating towards this type of product. And they're using the opportunity to really trade up.
The other thing I think it's important is to distinguish between Class A and Class A plus. Like, I think calling it Class A plus is exactly right. It's not enough to be Class A. The distinguishing elements for me are the age of the building, or the at least a recent massive capital infusion for a refresh on one of these towers. If it's old and it's aging, it's no longer Class A plus for sure. It may not even be Class A. And the other piece is a story as old as time in real estate. Location, location, location. Like, it has to be in the A plus location. One example of that, I think we've talked about it here on the pod before, the Irvine Company exiting downtown San Diego, call it Class A office market. You know, they sold Symphony Towers, arguably a Class A building, although it's not in the greatest location and it's starting to get a little bit old. $85 a foot, you know, took their losses and got out of town. So we're talking about Class A plus here, and that means it's new or like new and in the very premium location.
Yeah, it's, I couldn't agree more, John. And I would add that, you know, in some of these cases, these buildings even have outdoor spaces, you know, fitness centers. And when you talk about location, it's access to transit. Like, think if a majority of your population is coming in on transit, not driving to work, not having to walk five blocks or six blocks in inclement weather is obviously a bonus too. And so, you know, back to Tucker's point, he made a good point that even when if you started to kick off a project today, it's a minimum 3 years to get built. You look back at what has happened and you're like, well, what's caused this? Well, developers broke ground on only 14 million square feet of office space in 2024 compared to an average of 21 million square feet before the pandemic. That's 66% of normal. And like I said, you know, 3 years is aggressive. It sometimes takes 4 to 7 years to complete these projects. And so it's just, there's a lack of supply for this premium A plus stuff. And then not to mention during the pandemic, everyone was talking about conversions from office buildings to residential. Well, when that happens, that just further shrinks supply. And so it's interesting because you start to see for the first time in years, you know, landlords of top tier A plus properties starting to reduce tenant concessions in terms that they otherwise would have agreed to a few years ago. When I say concessions, for everyone's sake, you know, it's free rent, tenant improvement allowances, et cetera. And so we're starting to see, believe it or not, rents actually starting to rise. You know, in New York, there are cases where rents are now averaging $150 a square foot, which is a 20% increase over 2 years. Yet, there are still buildings in New York and other prime locations where rents are falling. And so what we've got a situation of is tenants are you know, competing for premium office space, and in some cases, shifting that power back to more of an equilibrium between the landlord and the tenant, which is rather astonishing to think about when the national office vacancy is still 20%.
Yeah, a couple points on that. First off, and my team here in Boston laughs at me, but Class A is really Class B now. Right? It's, you might as well lump it in. And Class B is Class C, because no one in a million years is going to a Class C building anymore. It's really hard to get tenants in a big way to go to Class B. And Class A is not Class A plus, and there is a major gap. There's a lot of blue ocean between A and A plus, and the quality of the building and the amenities and the location are the key drivers to that. So I think there's been a real shift, and it's funny, you've got the landlords of Class A buildings that continue to try to hang on. They're just getting dragged through the mud and dragged. And eventually they're going to have to let go and realize that their building is just cannot compete at the same level of these new buildings. But that's the first thing. The second thing they're doing, and I would say this is more of a phenomenon with Class A buildings versus the Class A plus, where that can really drive rent. Class A buildings, they're trying to hold the rents in a similar profile as the A plus buildings, or at least tell a story of why there's the discount that they're driving. But what they're doing is they're giving much larger concession packages, and not only giving concession packages that are massive, they're allowing tenants to apply 100% in renewals of those concessions, or of a TI allowance concession, to rent. So they can keep their face rents up. And if you're not going to do any work to the space, fine, just give us the money back as rent throughout your lease term. And that, I've seen portions of allowances in the past be able to be applied to rent, right? If you get a large allowance and you don't use it all in a refresh, the tenant always wants the relief valve to be able to apply that to rent as the, you know, kind of last portion. Which, what's new to me in these negotiations is landlords allowing us the opportunity to apply up to 100% of an allowance in a renewal to rent.
What's the profile of that landlord? I'm wondering, curious if it's a REIT, right? I mean, we get into this game where REITs aren't counting TI towards their FFO. Is that true if they're using their TI as effectively a mechanism for free rent?
No, it's the pro for the, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, John, it's a great question. I would tell you that the landlords that are looking for face rents to be able to exit, and they're looking at capitalized value versus fund FFO. So for our listeners, FFO is looking at cash flow predominantly, right? How profitable, how much does this building cash flow over our cost? The next profile, and the ones that focus on face rents, is the ones that are investment trusts, or who are investors that will capitalize a building and sell it into the marketplace. So they need to keep face rents up so they can capitalize the income stream and get a higher sale price. And they're the ones so focused on being able to apply concessions that effectively burn off in the beginning of deals to keep face rents up so building value is maintained.
So earlier when Owen was talking about rents for Class A plus office space in Manhattan being up by 20%, I think it's really important to sort of ask the question of, like, why aren't there new construction buildings in certain markets? And then also understand that part of the reason that rents have gone up by 20% is that when you look at the percentage of the Class A plus market that is actually available, probably most of that square footage is represented in the brand new construction buildings that are now delivering. And when you think about how do you price the other Class A plus inventory, that really the only supply competitor is new construction, they start pricing themselves as if they're new construction or slightly lower than new construction itself. So, you know, we were just talking about this with our Los Angeles team earlier in the week, is like, you know, you hear these stories about these insane rents being signed for, like Class A plus building in San Francisco, even in a market where, you know, office availability is in excess of, you know, 35-40%. You hear stories about it in New York of just these like almost unfathomable numbers that you're just not seeing in Southern California. And you start asking your question of like, why? And the reason is there's just not really new construction Class A plus buildings in these markets. And you know, when you think about what is making it viable for SL Green to build a, you know, 1.5 million square foot new construction Class A plus building at a just insane cost. I mean, you know, $2,000 a foot or $1,500 a foot or whatever the cost to, you know, acquire the land and throw these buildings up and then fund tenant improvements and, you know, fund free rent and downtime and all these different things. And the reason is in these Southern California markets, you just don't have the same headquarters dynamics that you have in New York and Boston with, like, obviously life science companies and, you know, Manhattan in general and San Francisco with big tech companies. Like, you're not going to have, you know, JP Morgan anchor your new, you know, Class A plus high rise in Century City or downtown LA or something for 500,000 feet. So they're just not getting built, which puts even more pressure on Class A plus rents because they don't exist. Yet Class A plus rents are much lower in LA than Class A plus rents are in San Francisco and New York because there aren't the new construction buildings pulling everything up with it. So it just, it's a pretty complicated dynamic. And a lot of people, they may not understand that even if Class A plus real estate is in demand, the financing costs for Class A plus real estate is still incredibly high. You know, if you were trying to build Class A plus real estate, you know, in San Francisco, and you start thinking about the cost of land, the cost of tenant improvements, the cost to build, like, you really can't build something new without expecting that you're going to at least get $150 a square foot a year triple net. I mean, like, if you're trying to hit a, you know, 8 or 9 or 10% return threshold, and you just think about where the risk-free rate is and where the cost of real estate debt is and the risk that you're taking building a brand new construction building over many, many years, it's like, it's a really tough business. And to get, you know, 9 or 10% returns building office space is just really hard, which is why you don't see new construction Class A plus office space, even though it is probably the most in-demand part of the office market, being built in really the majority of markets.
Totally agree. It's the Plaza District in New York, which is it's an office market that brokers denote in Midtown. It's the tightest submarket right now in Manhattan. And mostly it's because capital markets have literally suffocated the construction. And I don't know if that's going to change or not. But these projects to get built need anchor tenants. And the asking rates for some of these projects are $175 a square foot at the base of the building to upwards $300 at the top. And the question we're all waiting to see, I think, especially those that work in New York City, is there going to be resistance to that pricing or not? If you want to be in the Plaza District and you want to be in new construction, are you willing to pay $200 to $300 a square foot for office space? We might be. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, the capital markets component of that, remember, rates are up, so the cost of financing the projects are significant. There's a lot of lenders on the sidelines right now. If you talk to people in the business, there's a ton of lenders that effectively their books of business are not balanced enough where they can come back into the market and buy more debt. And then on the equity side, same thing. You've got equity that's deployed that hasn't turned over to be able to create new fresh powder that allows companies to get back in. So there's just a smaller pool of capital chasing deals. The cost of the deals is much higher. But I would be of the opinion, if the demand on the tenant side was there, you would find the capital to finance the projects. But a lot of times I'm hearing they're not. What's interesting, what they're actually finding, and we're seeing this in markets around the country, I think we kind of borrowed it from our friends from the north, is office projects that are mixed use with really high-end residential on the top of the buildings. So you're seeing Millennium Partners delivered a project here in Boston. There's a number of them down in New York that are being delivered. There's a couple others being considered that I know about here in the city where the condos can, and that's actually Heinz's project as well. So there's two projects here. The only two new construction buildings that one of them delivered and is about 50% leased. The other one is in construction at South Station with Heinz. Both have high-end residential components that have helped stabilize those assets and allow them to get financed at the time, you know, 3 years ago when they started, 4 years ago for one of them, probably 5 years ago when they started construction. But it's really cost prohibitive. And from a financing perspective, the cost of the improvements for the tenants is significant. So that's why TI allowances have gone through the roof. Rents have to stay with them. But if you're spending $400 or $500 a foot to build space, your landlords have to step up and bring more cash to the table to try to get tenants to leave their existing buildings.
A good discussion that, you know, I'm having with clients is like, when you start thinking about office decisions, you know, how should the company think about cost versus the employee experience, right? Like there's a huge delta in cost and subsequently, you know, a huge delta in experience. And, you know, you think about, can these aging buildings that are no longer Class A, can they survive? Because you can renovate a lobby. We all know that. You can find room in the building for a fitness center, but you can't move columns, right? You can't replace the windows. I mean, you can replace the actual window itself, but you can't make it bigger and bring in more light without unbelievable costs. And so, you know, what do you guys think the long-term impact is on this divide for these central business districts that have tremendous amounts of supply of these older buildings that are clearly inferior to the new stuff that's been built and will be built?
I think there's almost this like misconception around some of these companies that invest in having super nice space, like they're doing it to be nice or, you know, because they really care about their team and this and that. And like, not to say that they don't care about their team, but like people are investing in office space across a variety of different quality levels to make money. Like that's it. No one's like, hey, let's spend 50% more in office space so our team can be happy. Like, no, like people are saying, let's spend 50% more in office space because this is a recruiting tool that's going to allow us to get the talent that we need and retain them so we can accomplish whatever our company's objectives are and make money. And I think that along the spectrum of companies, if you're, you know, NVIDIA or something, and you're going, okay, or you're OpenAI, and you say, look, getting that one, you know, kind of like bleeding edge, like 0.0001% top AI, you know, expert is going to have a huge impact, then it makes sense to spend money on everything that you can to get that person, because it's very binary. You get the person, you're going to make a ton of money. You don't get the person, then it sucks, right? But there's all of these other companies that I feel like are sort of ignored, which are the companies that more look like the federal government, right? And these companies, I think, are going to invest in office space, and they're going to invest in the, you know, as Brian was saying earlier, the Class A space that's now the Class B space that is going to have this massive reduction in price, massive divide. And they're going to go, look, I want our people in the office because, you know, may sound harsh. I'm not saying this is all companies, but they might say, I don't trust our employees to work from home. I don't trust that they're being as, you know, productive as they otherwise would be if they were at the office where they can't, you know, sit in front of the TV while they eat lunch and, you know, walk their dog or whatever people are doing at home. So I don't know. I want to make sure that we clarify that. I mean, this is what companies care about. Companies care about making money. Public companies care about providing returns to their shareholders, and the time periods where the strategy of the company looks altruistic or like they're really putting their employees first, I would argue that they're putting their employees first because it's good for business, and that the employees aren't actually first. The shareholders are first, and the employees are like second or third, but the employees are second or third because it's a means to an end of making sure that the company is successful. And like, that's the incentive that's going to drive the reoccupancy of office space. That's an incentive that's driving the federal government to do what they do. And it's the incentives that are driving the like tier one, most competitive for talent companies in the world to spend tons and tons of money on the most premium office space they possibly can, when they could probably get stuff that is nearly as good at a, you know, 20 or 30% discount to what they're paying.
I want to go back to Owen's original question. What happens to these older Class A, Class B buildings? And I suggest that it's really pretty simple. And it's the same thing that always happens. There's this economic osmosis like a flow from high pressure to low pressure. I've seen it downtown, you know, tenants transitioning to the suburbs, and then downtown prices fall and tenants transition back downtown for value. I would suggest that, look, if it's old and obsolete, it will be torn down. And until it's old and obsolete and ready to be torn down, it's going to reduce in price. There's going to be a market clearing price. How low does it need to go before there's value there that a tenant who isn't chasing Class A plus is willing to go to an inferior location? There is going to be a market clearing price, and that's what happens to them. It's going to continue to decline until it finds a point in which its economic osmosis can come into play and the tenants flow back to those buildings because they can't pass up the value. That's what I suggest.
Yeah. You know, Tucker, the fact that you think at the end of the day, it all comes down to how much money the company makes and, you know, true capitalism. I agree with you to a certain extent, but the goals and objectives of certain leaders value the real estate and the experience of their people differently. Some companies are like, we're going to build an office and you're going to come or you're not going to work here. But I think the market has shifted over the last few years where people have realized that mentality is not going to get us the best people. And it's not even getting, even if we don't have the best people, we have our people and they're not going to be happy and we're not going to get the most productivity out of them if we don't give them something more than an office. We have to give them a really, really good office. And I think the market is continuing to evolve and shift where it may not be a one-to-one ratio to productivity or value, but there's a feeling in leadership that giving people a better office is going to make us better as a company. Where before it used to all be dollars and cents and it would just be about the money. Like, how much does this cost? How much does that cost? And I remember for years we would do comparisons of locations and it would just come down to what's the net effect of rent. And as a broker, you'd be like, guys, you're missing the point. Like, this building is in the best location. It's across the street from this. It has parking underneath it. It has this. It has that. It's, you know, next to this retail, next to this restaurant. It's a 3-minute walk from the train station versus a 7-minute walk. Like, your people are going to love it. And it was just a decision on that price because they were both Class A buildings or they were both, you know, Class B buildings. And that's the price range they were in. Now those soft variables are way more important because people want, it doesn't make them hire, it doesn't make them hire better people. It just makes their people happier and it makes their people want to come to work and it makes their people think that the company cares about them and they think that that is going to create a better product for them. And it might not be something you can measure on paper, but that's the feeling in the culture of the company. And I think there's more of that today.
So I think we're actually completely agreeing with each other here. The way that I think about what you just said is that the inefficiencies in the office market and the very wide variance about how companies think about office space spend and what quality of office space they should access is due primarily to a misunderstanding by all companies of the association and correlation of office space to performance. No one really knows exactly how high quality office space translates, like in a scientific, like, truly quantifiable way of we do this, we get this outcome. It doesn't really exist. I mean, people know that high quality office space drives performance across a variety of spectrums, whether it be recruiting, retention, happiness, productivity, so on and so forth. But no one knows perfectly what the correlation is, which is why there's no formula for how much somebody should spend on rent and all that. So I agree with you, Brian. I mean, I think because people are now valuing this thing a lot more than they valued it previously, that has made all of these decisions much more complicated and created a inefficiency in the market because of the inefficiency in understanding the office space's impact on performance and ultimately, by performance, I mean profitability of the company and long-term success of the company.
Yeah. So we are saying the same thing. I agree with you. And that's that I think today people want to try to figure that out more than they ever have. It doesn't mean we have better answers. I think what people are realizing that the easy thing is to just pick newer. And if you're in a Class B building that's 150 years old with only windows on the front and back, newer might be a 1970s building with glass on four sides wow, that's a huge upgrade for that company. It's the ability for them to be able to create what they feel is a better environment for their people. It doesn't mean it's going to the newest building. I do agree with you. But that science is, it's not science for our clients. It's a feel. It's more about what they think than the data that supports what's underneath it.
I'll also add is, I think, and I heard this from a client literally last night over text, because he's been contemplating on whether or not he should move to a nicer building and slightly expand. And the discussion was around having a growth mindset. And so, yes, he cares about his employees. It's got to be nice space, all that stuff. But for his reasoning, it was, I think we need to level up simply because I'm worried if we stay in what we have, which is nice. It's not a C building by any means. I'd say it's like an A. If we stay what we have, are we limiting our mindset in terms of what's possible? This company is doing incredibly well. The sky's the limit. And he's going to take a step up likely for the sake of what that says about the company, both internally and externally. Yes, his employees will be happier probably, but they're already happy with what they've got. But taking a step up to something even nicer, higher performing says, hey, no, we're here. Like, we're not a startup anymore. We're a profitable company. We owe it to ourselves to grow and expand, and what, where we work and how we work and the environment we find ourselves in every day is going to, you know, affect that in how we think about things every day at work. So all good stuff.
I mean, that's just another vector of like, what's the signaling of your office space say to the market, say to investors, say, I mean, it's just one of the other many reasons for the inefficiencies of what's going to ultimately provide for the best long-term success of the company. And I feel like it's really easy for landlords and real estate professionals and, you know, architects and all these people that are in this industry to sort of lose sight. Like, everything a company is doing is in pursuit of being as successful as possible, short of, you know, being a nonprofit or something. But even then, it's like your success just isn't measured in profitability. It's measured in impact. So these companies are really running themselves as well as they can. And every single thing is through the lens of like, how is this going to help us be successful? And obviously there's a bunch of lenses like, what's the signal to the market and our investors and what's the impact of that? But I mean, I think, Owen, this is just a point that it's so complicated to assess how much money to spend on office space and what the impact is and whether it's a, you know, the most optimized ROI for your company. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's super fun in our business. At least this is part of it that I get the most enjoyment out of, is to be able to understand a client's budget and give them something that's way over or better than what they traditionally have been able to afford, and to see the value, not on paper, but see the value when they move in of how excited and how much they love that new office that they get into. And it's part of that, like, how, where do you find arbitrage opportunities in the marketplace to give clients an opportunity to kind of get up into the next class of buildings and realize that, you know, and maybe they don't make any more money, but they love you for it, and the people love it. And it's really fun to have that experience. And this current market has afforded us as advisors and brokers and to do that for our clients, which has been really cool.
That's basic human psychology. People buy with emotion and justify with fact. That's what that's all about. And it's like when you are shopping for a home or maybe in an apartment or a condo, you know, you're looking at stuff that is, you know, in your quote unquote budget, and then you see something else and you're like, well, maybe my budget's a little bit more than I thought it was. I've seen that happen time and time again with office tenants, where they see, we tour what's in their, you know, defined budget, and then they're like, well, what about that building? Well, that's not in your budget. Well, let's take a look at it anyway. And then they end up going there. Yeah, that's human psychology at its best.
John, I know that you spent a bunch of time reviewing Alexandria's earnings report that just came out. I think it'd be great to talk about life sciences a little bit. I mean, definitely an industry where the competitiveness for talent is still very high. Very unique time in the real estate market. Alexandria, obviously one of the largest owners of life sciences in the world. Going through sort of a more challenged time than they were a few years ago, when they looked like the smartest real estate people to ever invest money in real estate. But tell us about the latest, what sentiment is, and what you think the future of Alexandria is in terms of performance.
Yeah, great. I thought it was timely. The Alexandria earnings call was Tuesday, and so I poured over the transcript of that, and I've just got a couple highlights to share, and we can sort of respond to what is being said. I'll say this. I think Alexandria and ARE is one of the premium operators for life science space. I think they're super smart. You know, the segment is challenged in terms of availability and vacancy, and it's super interesting to watch what happens next. But then this question of sort of keeping them accountable to market, what is market rent today? It's just really, really interesting. But let me go to some of the comments made by their team. So first of all, they sort of have this broad strategy to dispose of property that isn't part of their core strategy, which is these mega campuses. They've got certain locations they've determined to be a mega campus, and that's where they're going to invest for the future. And they're selling off the stuff that's not. But listen to the way they describe it. Here's their CFO. We're very pleased to have executed a strong finish to the year within our value harvesting asset recycling program, closing on $1.1 or $1.4 billion, which they then use to fund their other capital. But that's some great phrasing, value harvesting asset recycling program. Yeah, I thought that was fun. It's also smart, I believe. That was Peter Moglia that said that. The CFO then says, okay, catch this. The rental rate growth for lease renewals and releasing space in 2024 was solid at 16.9% and 7.2% on a cash basis. And for the quarter, it was 18.1% and 3.3% on a cash basis. And you tell me if you interpret this another way, you need to sort of nesting Russian dolls sort of unwind that and what he just said. So rental rate growth on lease renewals and releasing space. So he's talking about two different numbers, like renewals and leasing vacant space. In the last quarter, the renewals were up 18.1% and the vacant space was up 3.3%. So you want to talk about the premium that tenants pay when they renew their lease. Doesn't that speak to it directly?
Yeah, so I think the first thing on the whole harvesting thing, I've heard this could be completely different than what they're talking about. But here in Boston, my partner keeps correcting me and telling me it's not a new standard, Brian. It's been around, but Alexandria is using a different standard to measure their buildings, and they're slowly going through their portfolio. So in one case, there's an opportunity that we're working on, that the space used to be 90,000 feet and now it's 100,000 feet and nothing's changed, right? And landlords play this game. They go from, you know, BOMA 2007 to BOMA 2016 to BOMA 2021. And right, and every time it gets a little, somehow the buildings get a little bigger. I've seen it applied, and this isn't a BOMA standard. It's another measurement standard that I'm not familiar with, so I'm not going to name it because I haven't done enough research to actually understand it at all. But it's a standard that's not BOMA that grows life science buildings. So in a market where, or in a environment where you need to grow revenue, just make the buildings bigger. At renewal, your tenants have to pay more money. So that sounds easy, I think. But the other thing is Alexandria has kind of three main campuses here, and they've shed a lot of their tertiary product that they've owned in a big way. They've really kind of retrenched back to their three main campuses in Cambridge. And I would tell you, East Cambridge is strong for demand. People want to be in Kendall Square, and the market is performing really well as it relates to the overall market. Now, remember, Boston's 50 million square feet of life science space, of which, 17 million square feet of it is available right now. So it's, over 30% available. If you were to look in Kendall Square, it's very strong. And that's where ARE dominates. Well, they're not the only player in town, obviously, but they have two of their most of their campuses or most of their buildings, as you'd call it. So the market is very good for them in Boston.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, there's pockets of strength and pockets of weakness. By the way, the CFO goes on to say our outlook for full year 2025, same property growth is consistent with our prior outlook at down 2%. So they're acknowledging the reality there. Joel Marcus says, I think the only sore thumb is South San Francisco. Kind of a reckless oversupply there by people who really didn't know what they were doing. Super interesting. Yeah, the South San Francisco is an absolute nightmare. Let me share. So Peter Moglia says it this way. He's actually talking about Boston, but the same applies to what they just said about South San Francisco. There are zombie buildings. About 40% of the inventory in greater Boston probably won't lease because it's just not good quality. The sponsor has no experience. It's in the wrong location. And unfortunately, some institutional investors were so hyped up about life science, they funded some of that stuff and they've learned their lesson. And so I think he says, I think you're going to see life science at a lot of institutional real estate portfolios from here on out, but it's going to be with us or it's going to be with somebody else that has at least scale and experience. And there's a couple others, he says, but all these other fly-by-nights, wannabe developers that try to get into the space are just going to fail. And some of these institutions, institutional money will be lost, but they're not going to be soured on it because they know it's a good business and they know there's a use case for life science real estate. And they know that we're the ones that they may be partnered with. Super interesting.
There's a lot of life science companies going to lose their investments over the next few years that sit in tertiary markets. I mean, we were just looking at some land comps. IQHQ bought a piece of dirt for $27 million 2 years ago. They just sold it at the end of last year for $10 million less to New Balance. So in 2 years, and they did nothing to it. They didn't entitle it or anything. It just sat there. They lose $10 million. The other thing that's interesting in life science, because it's so expensive to build labs right now, anything that's existing second generation will lease first. But also landlords are increasing TI allowances just astronomically, right? So I'm looking at a list of comps right now, and you know, you've got rents. I won't name the deals for confidential reasons, but rents that are, you know, 114, 125, 110, TI allowances 115, 40, 250, 250, 225. Now we were just talking to an owner who owns a brand new building that's delivered, that's vacant. They will do a $95 net deal with over 400 in TI, right? So TI allowances that tripled to quadrupled, trying to attract new tenants and pull them out of existing space. So the market is in a really difficult position, and it's overall. Kendall Square is performing. There's a transaction that we'll announce when it gets done. That's a new headquarters for Biogen that, you know, is going to be built right in Kendall Square at the former Volpe transportation site. That'll blow those numbers out of the water. It'll probably be, you know, could be $150 a foot. I don't know, but it's very expensive dirt. It's very expensive to build. And they're going to go put their headquarters there, rumored, because that's where you want to be if you're in, you know, life science in New England. So it's an interesting market.
Yeah, somewhere in this transcript, I don't have it highlighted, but they acknowledge the fact that for a biotech build-out, the market's essentially gone to a turnkey model.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So here's something interesting that Joel Marcus says. I've got a couple more bullet points. He says, we have a really, really good picture, over 800 tenants of each and every market, and what they demand is quite apart from what people that the brokers may represent or what they see. They often don't see much of what we see, and oftentimes we may sign leases or LOIs where brokers simply aren't aware of those things. Huh. What's that? Let's translate that for him. Is that unrepresented? Yeah, just... And, you know, he's not wrong. They do have the stable of 800 tenants. They have really great relationships and they do get access and visibility. I would suggest that those companies should be represented nonetheless. And so here's one last thing. And so he sort of takes a stab. I guess they're getting a lot of pressure, people speaking out about negative expectations on ARE performance. He says, finally, it's interesting that like real world legacy media, there are always a bunch of legacy pundits who back in 2009 urged us to unload Mission Bay and Cambridge Land during the global financial crisis as worthless non-income producing assets that weigh on our balance sheet. And they turned out to be the growth engines of the next decade. Well, those legacy pundits are here again, and they got it all wrong. We look forward to our first quarter call where we'll give you an update on the strong leasing progress we're already seeing during this quarter and some strong new pockets of demand and give a peek into our 2026 transaction plans. Which, by the way, one of those pundits I presume might be this guy who I found on LinkedIn, Jonathan Litt, with Land and Buildings Investment Management. He's an activist investor and he's a thorn in ARE's side, I believe. He said on LinkedIn, he attended the Investor Day in December. He says, Investor Day landed, the ARE Investor Day, Investor Day landed like a lead balloon in our view. Occupancy in 2025 is expected to decline 270 basis points. GAAP NOI in 2025 is expected to decline 2%. Highly dilutive $1.55 billion of 2025 dispositions at 7% cap rate. Maintenance CapEx and TI up almost $200 million, likely in part to induce leasing. He says the wheels are coming off ARE in our view, given substantial lab space overbuilding, weak tenant demand, and lack of return to office lab post-pandemic. He goes on to say they do have a position in ARE. So look, I think ARE is a class operator. I think they're in a tough, tough market. Certain pockets are stronger than others. South San Francisco is one of the worst, and it's super interesting to dig. You know, you're talking about IQHB. They're a private REIT. We don't get this kind of data. They don't have to report to us. So, you know, the public REITs, we got to listen in and try and decipher what they're telling us.
I think that guy should chill. I mean, Jesus. Down 275 basis points when the market is 30% vacant. I think you got every life science landlord literally bleeding out, you know, on the operating room table, and ARE is doing much better, in my opinion, than the others. And they have an ecosystem within ARE. They do a lot of deals. I would say that the frequency, and this is just my gut, the frequency of them doing deals unrepresented is probably decreasing as more and more space hits the market. Because before, when the market was really tight, it wasn't about finding the right space. It was about finding any space at all. And ARE had better information because they controlled so much of the market that they could play kingmaker and put the puzzles together better than anyone, because they knew before the space hit the market how that tenant was doing, because they are very good at helping their tenants within their portfolio. They are very close to their tenants. They take good care of their tenants. They build good relationships with their tenants, and they know in a tight market, that's invaluable in how to help companies downsize, help companies grow, help companies do whatever they need at that particular time. Now there's vacancy everywhere, and their ability to kind of control that process has probably decreased. And that value has certainly decreased because companies are going to chase, especially in that sector where it's all about extending runway. If you've got 18 months of cash, how do I make it 24? If I've got 12 months of cash, how do I make it 24? If I got 24, how do I make it 36? Because funding is very difficult to come by. And your friends are your friends and your relationship, your relationships. But if you can find existing lab space that's going to help you extend your runway, you're going to jump at it. And it might be outside of their portfolio in some cases. And that's what we're seeing. Companies do that.
Yeah. Just as a comment to not necessarily defend ARE, but just give them a little bit of credit here. If I were a life science tenant and I were in a life science building, there's probably no other landlord I'd want to be leasing space from right now than Alexandria. The ones I'd be concerned about is, you know, that office to life science conversion that, you know, was so prolific during the pandemic that people were rushing to because that's where the demand was. People being the landlords were rushing to convert their office buildings to life science. You know, if you're in a multi-tenanted building like that, that's probably in the highest odds is an inferior building to what Alexandria offers. And I guarantee you that owner has an inferior balance sheet compared to that which ARE has. And so, they're going through some tough times, right? So is a lot of other landlords right now, office, even some industrial. But I have no doubt that ARE will chart a course forward. They've got very smart people working there. It's not the best times, but they'll persevere. There's no doubt. And yeah. And so if you're a tenant in an ARE property, no need to worry. They're going to keep the lights on. It will be business as normal. They may not get the returns they want necessarily relative to what they were a few years ago, but they'll be just fine.
Said shortly, said some more concisely, that investor should chill.
I agree.
Well, you brought up industrial. Why don't we, let's hit on the industrial side. Tucker, you got something for us?
I think it's really striking that when you think of all the different product types, you have such like different dynamics. I mean, in office space, we've spent, you know, 20 minutes talking about how Class A plus office space is outperforming basically every other type of office space. And in industrial real estate, obviously Class A industrial buildings are still commanding higher rents than second generation buildings, but it's sort of the opposite where the percentage of the industrial market that is available is predominantly new construction just by nature of sort of going into this more industrial kind of downward trend over the last couple of years with industrial vacancy in the, you know, low single digits in a lot of core industrial markets. So we still have this super low vacancy, but the product that's being delivered is, you know, no one builds a Class B new construction industrial building anymore. Everyone's building more or less the same product, you know, 36 to 40 foot clear, 50 to 60 foot column spacing, basically distribution buildings. And more or less everyone's building the same thing with, you know, maybe a tweak here or there on the, office portion facade. But yeah, it's just striking that Class A plus office space is the best performing component of office space. And, Class A industrial space is probably the worst performing, even though like on a relative basis, even though it has the highest rents, probably the worst performing component of industrial real estate. So it's very disconnected. But I mean, ultimately, industrial development nationally has been buffered pretty heavily downwards, and the health of the industrial market over the next 12 to 24 months is going to be primarily driven by what happens with demand. And there's obviously a lot of uncertainty around, how tariffs and different, policies of the new administration are going to impact industrial space, whether that be positively or negatively. I've heard arguments for both, right? You know, if somebody takes one piece of information around tariffs and is like, that's going to be really good. And the same person takes the same information, makes the argument that that's going to be really bad. So we think we're at this point of, really heightened uncertainty around what demand will look like over the next 12 to 18 months for industrial space. And that's really going to dictate whether we're back in this, oh my gosh, we're way underbuilt on industrial space because developers pulled back, which is exactly what happened with COVID. We had sort of these, black swan type of demand drivers at the same time that developers buffered supply and then rents exploded. So not saying that that is going to happen again, but supply is buffered and we have a lot of very unusual sort of unmarket tested dynamics that are happening that have the ability to potentially create another one of these demand surges, or conversely, maybe demand will continue to, shorten off a bit, in which case the market will continue to deteriorate. So it's a long way of saying we'll see how much space companies lease, and if they lease a lot of space, then expect the market to do well. And if they don't lease a lot of space, expect the market to not do as well.
Isn't it crazy how simple the formula is? I mean, this can all be explained by looking at supply. You know, into the pandemic, this whole sort of societal shock, office space, you know, weren't allowed to go to it. Like all of a sudden office space was, nobody was building it, and projects that were planned were put on hold. Like what's going to happen to office space? But the supply shock and the whole industrial supply chain, industrial builders got busy building, right? They delivered a whole lot of that new industrial product that you're talking about. And the same thing happened in life science. Life science to the rescue, right? mRNA and in a pandemic, all of a sudden life science was the darling. So they built a whole bunch of life science and everyone wanted to convert their office buildings to life science. So there's excess inventory in life science. There's excess inventory in industrial because they built into it. That's what builders do. Builders build. That didn't happen in office space. And now we find ourselves in, a lack of shiny new buildings because they weren't building it at the time. All this is really can be at the most basic level explained by the supply.
Yes and no. I think that the pricing has gotten out of whack. I think the high-end industrial space saw the opportunity to increase pricing, and they did. And now, as the demand falls off, they're reluctant to bring the pricing down to meet to rebalance supply and demand. I think some of it's a little bit more on a spreadsheet than it is in reality. That's my personal opinion. We just did it. We're finishing a transaction, 100,000 feet. I won't tell you where it is, but it's on the East Coast. We did a search, 263 buildings at the high level could have fit the requirement. And, you know, ultimately we picked one building, but there's a lot of product out there and this was not for high bay distribution. We eliminated that, and a lot of the buildings were high bay distribution, but there's a lot of product out there available, you know, at a broad brush. So it'll be interesting how that rebalances. I think pricing is a big component of it, because this particular building that we were doing the deal on, no debt, the owners owned it for a number of years, but it's more of a fragmented market, I think, in certain areas, and not like the Inland Empire probably, or Chicago, or, you know, some of these core industrial markets. These tertiary or secondary, I should say, not tertiary, are much more of a fragmented ownership group, where this was a small owner and he had no debt in the building. So effectively he could do a triple net rent wherever he wanted. And we were able to capitalize on that. So it'll be interesting how that rebalances.
Let's wrap up there. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Hopefully lots of good pieces of information on what's going on across office, life science, and industrial. We'll be back soon with episode 50.